Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Museum of Science. The Heart of New England, their new giant screen production, is narrated by Uzo Aduba and Mindy Kaling. You can see it now in the Mugar Omni Theater. Tickets and more information at mos.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie Egan broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. American farmers, already hurt by the U.S.-China trade war, are preparing for more pain ahead thanks to the government shutdown. That's because they won't be getting their insurance checks. This is unbelievable. To help them deal with the trade war's financial blow. Joining us to talk about this, how the government shutdown is affecting food safety and other headlines about food culture and food policy, is Corby Kummer. Corby's a senior editor at The Atlantic, senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and a BPR contributor. Hey there, Corby.
Hey there.
Great to talk to you, Corby, as always. So let's start with the government shutdown. The article in the New York Times describes the shutdown as a sucker punch for farmers who are already struggling. What's happening?
This is so good. It is a guy who's news director for an Iowa radio station. And what he's pointing out is, remember, we talked about the $12 billion bailout that Trump promised farmers hit by his dumb, senseless tariffs and the trade war in China that was, you know, he was holding American taxpayers ransom, as he is now with a shutdown, for $12 billion in damage and lost sales of soybeans and other huge crops to foreign markets that farmers in the U.S. relied on, and essentially subjecting them to years of losses for lost contracts when these other countries in Europe and China just looked to other competitor producers and said, we're going to contract with you for a couple of years, so too bad, U.S. farmers. Well, now those farmers can't even get those checks because of the shutdown. So they can't apply to that. They're not getting those checks. They're completely paralyzed also by the lost market and not being able to get loans.
So what are they going to do?
They wait, like everybody else. They're just waiting. By the shutdown.
They've been completely screwed, and this blundering crisis, as the Iowa writer says. What's going to happen? Big Ag is going to swoop in and buy up farms that are going to go into receivership and decide, throw in the towel, have to sell because we've got one punch after another and we just aren't going to get up again. And as happened in the farm crisis of the 1980s, we are looking at the loss of a new generation of farmers.
You know, I am so glad you said that, by the way, because the immediate takeaway from this story is the short-term impact, which is horrible on these family farmers. But the long-term impact, it's almost as if it's a conscious act as opposed to being oblivious to the pain that's being caused to so many individuals by this shutdown. But here, an end is achieved that may be one that is supported by those responsible for the shutdown, the disappearance of the family farm and the expansion of the agribusiness. No, Corby?
Yeah, deliberate or not, it's just a gift to Big Ag, the consolidation of agriculture that's been underway for decades anyway.
By the way, a friend of mine and yours, Marjorie, runs a place called Farm Aid. And if you want to read about the importance of the family farmer in American life and also the pain being caused to the family farmer by so many policies coming out of Washington, go check out their website, farmaid.org.
So, Corby Kummer, apparently we're not supposed to panic because the shutdown is not making food unsafe. I read this story and then I discovered that the FDA only inspects most plants once every few years. And I thought, wow, maybe I should be in a panic all the time then.
Well, you probably should be. So, first of all, there's this historically intractable division of inspection. USDA, the Department of Agriculture, inspects fresh meat, and they have not been ceasing their inspections.
That's good.
Mostly because, as with everything, slaughterhouses don't want to be left with uninspected food and then have a crisis and lose business. But the FDA, which does all non-meat inspections, lets 99% of its workers, its factories, its 80,000 factories, go uninspected for years at a time because it's this huge burden and they just don't have time or or wow. manpower or woman power to inspect anything other than these 99% more than once every few years.
So wait a second. So let me restate what Marjorie said. It's not that we should feel assured that our food is safe. We should feel assured that it's no less safe
exactly.
than it is any other time because the inspections are so infrequent. I was stunned by
Me
what
too.
Marjorie was stunned by.
Well, every few years, once every 5 years they show up. Boy, a lot of damage could be done between 2018 and 2023.
Corby, when those very rare inspections happen, does the manufacturer or producer know in advance that the inspector is coming, or are they surprise inspections?
No, and that's very important. It's the whole idea that you could be surprised any day and then fined or shamed publicly if you're in trouble. Therefore, a lot of food industries have voluntary inspections. So they have their own programs, and they say no, since the FDA isn't particularly vigilant, doesn't have that many inspectors, we're going to have our own program. As happened with, for example, lettuce. Lettuce and leafy greens are a big, important example in the past year of huge recalls,
yeah.
like the national recall of romaine. That industry knows it's in trouble because there aren't enough inspectors available from the FDA, which is what does those leafy greens and other non-meat products. So they institute their own voluntary programs. The problem is they're not that vigilant, and so even with, you know, very good voluntary inspection programs in place, Western Arizona had this big leafy green scare and foodborne illness outbreak last fall.
So, Corby Comer, this is a sad story. People may know Haley House. It's in Dudley Square. It's been there, I think, 2005 is when it started. It's shutting down because it can't make ends meet. Tell people what it
temporary,
is.
So it's temporary, and I love Haley House. Have both of you been
I've been
to
there.
Yes,
right
yes.
Right across from the Morgan Memorial?
Exactly.
So they're a great food service organization that since 1966 have been providing food aid, classes to people, and they have this great cafe that was a big, airy, open, exposed brick place. They were able to buy that building in 2015, and they had a cafe that served healthy food. It employed returning convicts, returning citizens as they're called, it gave them food service jobs and training. It was a great gathering place for Dudley Square, and I would, when I was teaching at Northeastern, I would take groups of students just for a tour of the place and talks with their really dynamic trainers. It was a great place. And Bing Broderick is the guy who really set it in motion and has been is now going to look actively for new plans to reopen it. And I emailed him my condolences. And he said, nope, we're going to reinvent ourselves and we're going to be back.
What does that mean, reinvent ourselves?
It means figure out how they can try to lose less money and reopen.
Well, isn't it you can just give, you don't pay full price, you can just give a donation or something?
I think at Haley House you could give a donation, but it wasn't like the charitable restaurants like Panera has,
yep.
Panera Cares, where you pay whatever you want. In this case, there was a floor price. It just wasn't covering the expenses of labor and the heat and the light.
We're talking to Corby Comer. Corby, we're going to take a rare moment to say something very good about the Supreme Court of the United States, which declined to hear challenges to these animal welfare laws that were passed by voters in California and the one here. And if people don't remember, I think it was 2016 here, where the voters, it was overwhelming, almost, I think it was almost 80-20, said that you can't sell hens, the product of hens or pigs and some other animal, I'm not sure, if they can't, you know, lie down, move around. I mean, it's good, but it's pathetic that this is the level, this is the best we can do. They have to be able to fully extend their limbs and that sort of thing. And essentially, they were challenged by industry officials. And in both these cases, Massachusetts and California, the animal welfare rights things, for lack of a better expression, were upheld. Am I not correct about that?
So this is really important because California got there first in 2008 with a ballot initiative called Prevention of Farm Animal Cruelty Act, which indeed mandated space for animals, humane treatment. And what happened, the states around California said, you know, fine, we're just going to undersell Californians. And the California legislature, to protect California egg raisers and animal producers, said, we're not going to allow the sale. So these carpetbaggers from out of state can't come in and undercut our markets because they have to certify, too, that they upheld the same standards that our 2008 ballot initiative mandated. And so these challenges have been working their way up the courts for years because trade associations in other states hate them because they force them, out-of-state producers, both out-of-state Massachusetts and California, to spend money on giving space to animals, more personnel that will treat the animals better. They don't want to be subject to these, you know, whimsical, liberal, blue states that decide we care about animal welfare. So I think it's great that for whatever reason, Supreme Court decided we're not going to hear these challenges from trade associations. We're just going to let the laws stand.
And by the way, I think the Massachusetts ballot law, correct me if I'm wrong, Corby, did in its original form what California did, I guess, as an amendment. I believe that our law speaks to the sale of products from pigs and hens.
Right, it did, because it was 8 years later, and they learned from California.
Okay, that's great, actually. The Supreme Court rules on behalf, I would say, of the
Do we know where Judge Kavanaugh was on this? Was he for the freeing the chickens?
He was at the bar when the decision was made, so...
He was
having a beer.
He was at the bar. He liked the beer.
Okay.
Corby Cummer, so...
Oh, no, they declined to hear the challenge. So I don't know if we actually know what the... I don't know if there's a roll call taken, but the court...
Okay, so we don't know. We don't know what Kavanaugh thinks about chickens yet.
No,
we may find out going forward what he thinks about chickens and foie gras. One of those words I have very difficult...
You said it well.
You just did very well.
Beautifully,
it's a struggle for me. Anyway, Corby, another shocking story about so many college students hungry.
This is one of the great issues of our time. There are so many reasons that so many students are suffering from food insecurity, not quite knowing how they're going to afford their next meals or having sleep for supper, as one heartbreaking student post in another story about this said. So there's lots of reasons that 2 million college students who are eligible for food stamps aren't getting them. First, the fact of why they're hungry. It's that the ironic result of increased access for lower-income students to higher education means that there are many more hungry students. Why? Because students who would rely on free supplemental lunch programs, there's never been that safety net in colleges. Colleges were traditionally the province of the elite. White-collar families didn't have to worry about hunger, so there was never any national need to provide some kind of safety net to give students food so that they could study, as we all know is absolutely essential for elementary school and high school students. But that hasn't existed. And since 1975, the number of low-income high school graduates in college has more than doubled. And so this hunger is a really important issue. Students don't know that they're eligible for SNAP, and what's worse is there's this catch-22. So if students, because SNAP rules vary state by state. So, for example, in New York, this article in New Food Economy gave an example. A City University of New York student is earning less than $12,000 a year, so absolutely she thought she qualified for SNAP. But in New York, the college aid program says that you're only allowed to work 17 hours a week. But in New York State, you have to work at least 20 hours weekly to be a student who can get SNAP. So she's unable to get SNAP. And her teachers, including Janet Poppendick, who studies student hunger and has for decades, says, I don't want my students working 20 hours a week. You know, this is a terrible rule.
What is the response of universities, since you work at one, when was the story about Northeastern's dorm in the Globe the other day where it's
$2,300
a unit or whatever? So in addition to the tuition and fees and textbooks that cost $300 a piece to go, universities, some, not all, go out of their way to make it college even more affordable, where you do have to choose between school and sleeping and books and food. I mean, it's just, it's amazing to me that there seems to be such colossal insensitivity. And by the way, the meal plans at a lot of these joints are really, really expensive as well, are they not?
They're very expensive, and part of that is that colleges see food as an incentive and a recruiting tool. So when you go on college tours, you're often given the huge choice of allergen-free foods, the separate production lines that allow non-allergenic foods, and organic and sustainable. And you know, it's great that colleges offer that, but they are going to have to step up to offer more assistance. And, you know, some colleges locally are instituting quietly food pantries and food banks. And they have, like, secret hidden bookshelf entrances so that other students don't see them, and it reduces the stigma. But that's kind of a Band-Aid now. There has to be some kind of systemic addressing.
So we'll charge you $60,000 to go here, but we'll have a food pantry on the backside of the dorm. It's obscene. You know, speaking of obscene, I really worry. When I read that Mario Batali, who most people know that after he was outed for his sexual misconduct, decided to apologize with a recipe for a cinnamon bun or whatever it was at the end
of pizza dough.
A good taste kind of thing.
So it appears that whatever charges were being considered against Batali, I think there were three, have disappeared, which makes me very nervous, even though I know the cases are not connected, that even Harvey Weinstein, some of whose charges have disappeared, could also walk free. Does the fact that there are no pending criminal charges against Mario Batali, and obviously we've all heard about the so-called rape room that he in part was an investor in, does this mean that he'll be welcomed back into the industry you cover because he was not cleared but not prosecuted, or does he continue to be tainted goods, I hope?
I don't think he's ever going to be welcomed back. New York Magazine did a really well-reported and long story about him just a few weeks ago, in which the reporter went out to northern Michigan, where he has a family home. And all of his sources, the New York Magazine reporter sources, had said, you're never going to find Mario. He's in Europe. He's in South America. He's in Australia. And there he was at his lakeside home. And he was very nice to the guy, and he said, not going to talk to you. I don't live in public anymore. And at the end, he gave the reporter a plate of food and made sure that he got food. But that was that. He's not going to be back in the food industry. But what this points out, the dropping of the cases, is how hard it is to get evidence. Women don't remember. They admit that they were drunk. They're unable to provide sufficient evidence for investigators and prosecuting attorneys to go on. And, you know, that's why, for example, the Manhattan district attorney was given hell for not prosecuting Harvey Weinstein when there had been a complaint a year before the New York Times published its Pulitzer Prize-winning story. But again, there wasn't evidence, and in fact, those cases are one by one being dismissed.
Well, can I interrupt you? Due respect, I do not agree. We're talking about Cy Vance, correct? The Manhattan
yes.
DA. I do not. I mean, Cy Vance is the one who also refused to prosecute the Trump kids for what, on its face, seemed to be clear criminal acts vis-a-vis this Trump Soho
Grand
or whatever
Hotel.
The hell it was, where they're misrepresenting
things.
Well,
there's also statute of limitations, if you mentioned that.
Right, and he refused to prosecute Weinstein, where there was not a statute of limitations problem, at least on one count, where the woman had the tape. She had an audio recording of him groping her against her will. And correct me if I'm wrong, either of you, he decided not to prosecute that case, even though on its face, at minimum, in my estimation, there was enough to go to a jury. And if a jury decides to acquit, they decide to acquit. So I would have to say his history is going after people who don't deserve to be gone after, like that Abacus, that Chinese-owned bank in Chinatown in New York City.
Oh, yeah, the only bank prosecuted after
right,
the 2008 disaster.
The 2600th biggest bank in America.
Yeah.
And failure to prosecute people who deserve to be prosecuted. I think that's...
Well, first of all, I don't remember what evidence he had or ignored for Weinstein that he refused to prosecute. I do know that he wins hundreds of millions of dollars against the finance industry, because that's in Manhattan, and he decides what he wants to do with that money, and that has involved building basketball courts and athletic facilities at schools to prevent students from going into the drug trade, and it has worked. So everything is mixed picture.
Well, so, let's talk before we go about this nudist restaurant in Paris. Apparently, it lasted, I think, 15 months, and they're shutting it down because not enough people want to dine in the nude, which is probably a very good thing.
A good thing
there?
For everybody.
Were you there or no, Corby? You've been virtually
No,
everywhere.
I haven't had the pleasure of doing that.
That's too bad.
And neither the owners, who were twin brothers, weren't nudists. And they didn't. They just saw a business opportunity. They saw an opening. You know, everything has a double entendre when it comes to this story. But there weren't enough customers, or as I think the New York Post said, butts and chairs.
Yeah, that was a good line. Remember, there was this place we used to meet for our show down on Harrison Avenue, that coffee shop that had a gym right next to it.
Oh, sure.
And people would come in there.
It's a great restaurant there now, by the way, the name of which escapes me. But
there used to be a coffee shop.
Yeah, I remember that.
And they would come in from working out, and they'd have their little teeny tiny shirts on. You could see everybody's underarm hair and stuff like that. It just doesn't add to the dining pleasure.
Well, you mean Mike's Gym and Gaslight?
Yes, it's Gaslight.
It was
exactly
next door.
It is, yes.
Okay, yeah.
It's now a Boston sports club.
Okay. Well, there used to be a coffee shop there, and it was disgusting.
See, I would say to Marjorie at that time, when she would say that at our meetings, you really don't have to look at their underarm hair. You know, it's there, but it isn't like there's
they're
a
right
mandate
next to
that
you
stare at
sweating
it.
In their gym shorts and little
tiny
shirts.
So the thing
shirts
about the French restaurant is it shows what libertines the French are about lots of things, although they're prudes about other things. So you can actually go on museum nights. There are nudist nights in certain Parisian museums.
Yeah, I've read about that.
But now we've seen, and the Times even posted these provocative pictures of people's bare behinds. And, you know, it's stuff you don't necessarily want to look at.
Exactly.
Whereas at least the restaurant confiscated the cell phones. It ushered people into a changing room, and it said, you're going to leave your cell phones here. Show us the cell phone. We'll lock them up. So at least the other customers weren't subjected to have their bare behinds appear in the New York Times.
Corby, let me just say, had they allowed people to keep their cell phones, they'd probably still be in business. So that's all I'll say on that.
No, they wouldn't, because it's like when you go to a nude beach and you go visit the nude beach, and the people that should be on the nude beach are not there, and the people that shouldn't be there are there.
Ain't it always the way?
It is always the way. That's why they're generally pretty disappointing.
Corby, it's great to talk to you, as always. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Corby Kummer. Corby Kummer, a food writer, joins us every week. He's senior editor at The Atlantic, a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and a Boston Public Radio contributor. Up next, how is the government shutdown affecting travel? Boston Globe travel writer Christopher Muther joins for that and much more next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. We are live, as we are every Tuesday, from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.